Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Aurora Griffin, a magna cum laude graduate of Harvard University and a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford University in the class of 2014. Ms. Griffin is the author of How I Stayed Catholic at Harvard, published by Ignatius Press in 2016. She served on the Trump presidential transition team and later as a strategy and policy advisor in the Global Engagement Center at the U.S. Department of State. Currently, she works as a senior writer for the Catholic University of America and is a junior research scholar at the Center for the Study of Statesmanship, also at Catholic University. There, she is charged with advancing the scholarly mission of CSS by promoting published writings and lectures on campus related to U.S. foreign policy that are designed to challenge undergraduate students to reevaluate many assumptions undergirding that foreign policy. The Center on Statesmanship is a new institution in its first few months of existence, having been founded by William Smith and Klaus Rinn. We will link to that organization, Ms. Griffin's book, and related podcasts over at our website, so please stop by and visit. We'd love to have you in our companionship. Aurora, welcome to Research on Religion.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
So we're here to discuss your fascinating personal story of this journey through secular academia, both the challenges and the opportunities. But I want to start at the present and take a moment to talk about this new institute you're working for, the Center for the Study of Statesmanship at Catholic University. What's going on there?
Well, as you mentioned in the introduction, this is a really exciting new sort of think tank at the Catholic University of America. The Catholic University of America was founded to, in part, to help give to the Republic her best citizens. And I think that the Center for Statesmanship is doing precisely that. It's trying to think about how the Catholic Church and its rich intellectual tradition can be brought to bear on today's most pressing political issues.
So do you have some projects that you're working on? I know that we're only a few months into the founding of this institute or, you know, pushing the go button on it, but are there certain things that you're looking forward to in the next year or two that are should be on our radar screen?
Definitely. Well, what I can tell you is that it is early, but the initial proposal that I submitted has a variety of op-eds, lectures, and even a possible conference proposal on the relationship between Catholic social teaching and U.S. foreign policy. So I'm interested in questions like, so what does metaphysics have to do with the conflict in the Middle East? And I'm really looking forward to doing work that combines my interest in theology with my experience in government service.
Now, how did you end up getting connected with this institute? Because it's all of this, it's a brand new thing. You're walking around. Did you see something posted on a telephone pole and say, you know, tear off this little sheet of paper and sign up? How'd you get connected?
Well, these days we have something called the internet that has some advertisements on it. But I think probably I saw something online. The Catholic University has this initiative called the Institute for Human Ecology, and the Center for Statesmanship is the latest outcropping of that project.
Very cool. I'll have to check out this internet thing. It sounds wonderful. We are here to talk about your new book that was published in 2016 entitled How I Stayed Catholic at Harvard University, and that sounds really cool. Provide us, though, with a bit of pre-collegiate background. Who was Aurora Griffin growing up, and how did she get to Harvard? I never got to Harvard, so I want to know how you could get to Harvard in case I want to go.
I see. Well, you're going to have to take the SAT. You know, so I grew up in Southern California. My family is sixth generation Californian, so we've been there for a while. and were very Catholic. My father taught me directly from the Baltimore Catechism, which is kind of the old school, traditional catechism. And I was always taught that my faith was something really serious. I think my parents had planned on me going to a Catholic school like Thomas Aquinas College. But I had other ideas. I actually have never been to a Catholic school. I went to Protestant elementary, middle school, and high schools. And when it would have come time for me to do that, I had already had my mind set on Harvard for a long time. I think I saw the movie Legally Blonde when I was 10, and Elle Woods went to Harvard. And I said, so I guess Harvard's the place to go. And I was set on it from that age.
Yeah, interesting how we pick our schools sometimes. I ended up going to UCLA because it was west of the Mississippi and had a good basketball team. So you're a Southern Californian, and now you've been living on the East Coast. How is that adjustment? I'm curious because I'm a Westerner, and every time I go east, it's always odd.
Nobody told me it was so cold.
Yeah, we're doing this taping here in late January, and you've been hit with that blizzard bomb or whatever that was. So
yeah, some Arctic freeze. You know, I've lived on the East Coast for about 10 years now. I'm getting used to it, and I really do like the pace of life here. So I could see myself being here long term.
Okay. I want to ask a little bit more about the college experience, because I have a son who is in the process of applying to schools now as well. Was applying to college a pretty competitive and stressful period of your life that I guess it would be kind of the junior, senior high school year period?
Incredibly.
Yeah.
You know, there really is something difficult about taking your resume for the first time in your life, taking everything you've done and putting it on paper in an objective way and sending it to people who don't know you and having them tell you whether or not you make the cut for them. It's terrifying. It's really stressful. What I try to remind students who are going through that process now is that schools have all kinds of criteria that they're trying to use to fill a class. It isn't just about who's better than who. It's about what they need. Do they need a tuba player? Do they need a football player? Do they, you know, they need their next philosopher. So I tell students to take heart in knowing that that's it's not an objective measure of their excellence, and certainly not a measure of their worth. I wish that in that process I had had a bit more presence of mind to know that the outcome of my college applications wasn't related to my worth as a human.
Yeah, that's a hard message at that point in time in your life, and it's one that I stress to my son and his friends as well, too. And I know our higher education system puts such high stress on this period in their lives. Did you apply to other places other than Harvard?
Well, I had applied to Stanford Early Action.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got in, I knew I only had to apply to a handful of places. I applied to Harvard, Dartmouth, a couple UC schools.
So very good. You must have an extremely good portfolio to be getting into Stanford, Harvard, and all these places. When you're heading out to Harvard, did you have an idea of what your major was going to be, or at least a vision of your professional trajectory, and did that change over time?
I did. I was set on being a cardiothoracic surgeon.
Wow.
I was going to study biomedical engineering, and I was going to do philosophy for fun on the side.
Yeah.
And then the philosophy and theology sort of took over the whole thing. I think it was pretty early in my college career that I read a biography of a female neurosurgeon who was married to another neurosurgeon, and they talked about how they loved their job, but that their jobs were their lives. And I made the decision at that point that while I wanted to love my job, I wanted to love other things and have other things in my life. So I stepped away from the pre-med track.
Give us a sense of what it was like to be a student at Harvard from a secular sense. We're going to dig into the aspects of being a religious person, of specifically being a Catholic at Harvard, as your book title says. But just, you know, 4 years, I would assume you've been there for, we went there for 4 years. What was it like just being a student? What was the growth period from being a freshman all the way to a senior?
Yeah, that's a great question. Harvard was an incredible place to be during those 4 years. You meet so many people who are excellent in their fields. So you show up, and in high school, everybody's being measured by roughly the same criteria, your standardized tests, your APs, your extracurriculars. And then you get to Harvard, and everybody goes into their own fields and starts showing how their particular type of intelligence is being put to use. And what I found was that when I got over trying to measure myself against everybody else and started appreciating the excellence of my peers in their fields, I learned so much from them. So if you can figure out how to sit down and talk to the mathematician about what he's learning in a way that, you know, you can understand, you gain so much from that. So that's one thing. And I also learned that at every level, I think people tell you that you can stop striving, that you've made it to Harvard, this is, you know, this is the best school, and now any opportunity you want is going to be open to you, and don't worry about it. And that's not true. Mm-hmm. There are competitions that I had to compete against several hundred students for 10 spots in my freshman seminar. The competition doesn't stop once you get to Harvard. And so you can make a decision to tap out, but it's much more fulfilling to never think that you've quite made it, to continue to strive to be excellent in whatever way that you can.
Were there any big aha moments or pivotal moments that changed your view on life at Harvard? And speaking as a professor, too, were there any professors that really stood out to you that said, wow, this person really changed my life, the way I look at the world?
Right. I came into Harvard with a very established worldview. My time of questioning what my life was about came in high school. And so the teachers who I really think impacted and changed my life, the direction of my life, came in high school. And that was when I was trying to decide between existentialism and Christianity, and Christianity and Catholicism. By the time I got to Harvard, I knew what I was looking for. And so I picked out and pursued mentorship relationships with professors who I knew would support me in the decisions that I'd made to be a strong Catholic on a secular campus. And I absolutely would love to give a couple of them shout-outs. Richard Tarrant, I met freshman year. He was teaching his Rome of Augustus class, which in part convinced me to be a classics major when I thought I was doing philosophy. And we ended up getting lunch once a month or so throughout my college career. He supervised my thesis. We continue to exchange letters now. And another professor, James Hankins, intellectual historian, I took four classes with at Harvard, including a private tutorial on Aristotle's Ethics. And that was intellectually forming and character forming. It was an amazing experience. So both of these, I saw both Professor Hankins and Professor Tarrant just a few weeks ago when I was in Boston. So these are relationships that I anticipate continuing well beyond my college years.
If you could give some advice to college students out there, and we get a number of students who listen to this podcast as part of their college courses around the country, is there any advice you'd have in getting connected with a professor? I work at the University of Washington, and I see hundreds of students in the class. It's kind of a big sea of faces. It's a very large university. Harvard's pretty large, too, and many of these faculty members are off doing their research. They're pretty big names and things. How do you get connected to these faculty members?
I think you take initiative. So you do the work for your class so that you're engaged and you can ask questions. Go up to the professor after class. I mean, if he's not running off somewhere, and ask a question. Show up to office hours consistently. So at the beginning of the semester, when I was making my class calendar on my Google Calendar, which is on the internet, I put in the different office hours, like, as part of my class schedule. And I just went to office hours as often as I could. So the professors got to know me that way. And then from there, I would extend invitations, or invitations would naturally arise to get together outside of the office.
Very cool. Lesson to all you students out there, your education is in your own hands, and take that initiative. Let's dive into your book, though. That's why we're here, to talk about this book. And your book starts out by telling a vignette about a dinner that you had with family, friends, and some of these professors following your graduation in 2014. Take us to that moment and tell us what happened there.
Sure. This is a great story. It was graduation night, and my family had booked out my favorite restaurant in Cambridge, which was called Ten Tables. And as Professor Hankins liked to say, and four parking spots. And we all got together. It was probably 30 of us. And one of my family's traditions for graduations or big events is to initiate a toast in which everybody has the opportunity to say a few kind words about the honoree. So this night, my parents started a toast saying how proud they were that I was graduating from Harvard. And what I was expecting in this toast was for everyone to join in and say, "Wow, look at you. You did so well. You graduated in the top 5% of your class. You did the Rhodes Scholarship. You've just impressed us so." And they didn't. What they said, even the professors, was, "You know what really strikes us about you is that you remained committed to your faith, and that you were an example for others and for us in the way that you lived this." And I wish I could say, "Oh, that's so wonderful. Doesn't that fit well in the book?" But I didn't respond that well to it at the time. I was like, why are we talking about this? Why aren't you talking about my accomplishments? I worked so hard to be here." And then it was only kind of over time that I realized that actually the most important thing that I could have possibly graduated Harvard with was my faith.
That's a very deep thought in terms of that, and a deep reflection. It's probably fortuitous that toast came up, because it did lead to your book, How I Stayed Catholic at Harvard, which is kind of neat. Let's rewind the tape a bit and go back to that first semester of college now. And what was the first day like, or the first semester, both intellectually, socially, and religiously? Was it what you expected? Because, as you mentioned, you grew up in Southern California, went to a number of religious schools, in a very Catholic family. Then all of a sudden, here you are on the East Coast in Boston. It's Harvard is, I would guess, a secular university, even though it has a divinity school, and et cetera. But it's a much different environment than what you were in high school. So what were those first few days, weeks, and months like?
Sure. So I'll break it down intellectually, socially, and religiously. I think that's a nice way to do it. So as I had mentioned, I came in as a biomedical engineering student, and I still knew that I was going to do some philosophy on the side. So I was taking an introduction to philosophy course, and the third lecture was supposed to be about Thomas Aquinas. It was kind of the medieval link between the ancient philosophers and the moderns. And when the time came for the professor to talk about Thomas Aquinas, he skipped over him. He went straight to Descartes. And I went up to the professor after, and I said, what's the deal? Why'd you skip Aquinas? And he said, well, nobody takes Aquinas seriously anymore.
Mm.
And I thought, you know, I take Thomas Aquinas pretty seriously. So I don't know that this is a great fit for me. So I went to the classics department where, you know, I don't think they were crazy about me spending as much time in the medieval period as I did, but it gave me the opportunity to, I found the classics department through those kind of early, those early intellectual struggles. Socially and religiously are kind of tied together, but let me say a quick word about socially. If there are students who are listening to this in their early days of college, I think something that people don't tell you is that nobody makes their best friends in the first semester. I think everybody expects that they're going to go in the first week, they're going to you know, meet these lifelong friends that define their college relationship. And it seems and it feels like when you get to campus, everybody already has this figured out. They have parties to go to. They have friends to do things with. And everybody wonders, why am I not fitting in? But the truth is, everybody feels that way. Everybody's experiencing the same thing, and they're faking it until they make it. And in fact, a lot of people spend second semester trying to undo friendships that they formed in the first. So what I would say is I took a little bit of time in finding my friendships. I was a little lonely. I did end up without plans sometimes because I was trying to find the right people. And they came into my life pretty quickly. I was blessed. But I would say if you experience loneliness and you feel like everybody else has it together, that's not true. Everybody's trying to figure it out, and that's okay. These things take time. Then, religiously, I tell students that it's a great idea to think about that first decision that they're going to make on a college campus, away from their parents for the first time. So, you know, your mom has just helped you unpack your futon and your IKEA posters, and she drives away, and you're on your own. You can make your first decision as a college student. Go find the Catholics, is what I say. Go find the Catholics immediately. Go find out what time Mass is. Find out where the Catholic group is. Find out where your parish is, and have that be the first step that you take toward it. It's not what you have to do all the time every day, but just have it be the first thing that you do so you're plugged in. Otherwise, it can be months. You know, students can be on campus and say, oh, yeah, I've been meaning to find church, but I just really haven't gotten there. So my first thing that I did is I went and found the Catholics. I went to morning Mass on the first day of classes, and I discovered that there was a group of students that got together every morning. They went to Mass together, they prayed, and then they had breakfast together. And they were people who couldn't have been more different from each other. They were studying all kinds of different disciplines. They had different, if clashing, personalities and various extracurricular commitments. But they had the most important thing in their life in common, which was their faith. And that was a really beautiful kind of substitute for a family that was available for me even from day one on campus.
Very interesting. Let's I want to break in and just with a bit of surprise from what you said a little bit earlier, that the professor in your philosophy class skipped over Thomas Aquinas, as nobody takes him seriously anymore, because as a political economist, not a philosopher or a theologian, all of us economists are kind of going back and looking at Thomas Aquinas because he has a bunch of stuff on price theory in there, just prices and stuff in the Summa Theologica, which is very cool. So read your Thomas Aquinas, I tell you all. The other thing I said a little bit earlier, and I want to get your impressions on this, is I said that Harvard is kind of a secular university. Well, ostensibly it's a secular university. It began as a religious-based school and does maintain a divinity school. So as a Catholic going into that environment, did you see it as a religious school? Did you see it as a secular school? What was your vision of it, and how would you categorize Harvard now?
As far as I can tell, it's a secular school. If you go to the divinity school, I think that's a different story. But for somebody studying the arts and sciences, it's the liberal arts college. It's not discernibly religious.
Okay. Let's dive into your book now. And you have a list of 40 different things to help people who are religiously based navigate their way through an environment like this. And it's a great book because it speaks to a lot of young people and also speaks to their parents too. So I think that's really cool. It's aimed at Catholics, because it's Catholics in the title, but I would recommend this book to everybody of a religious persuasion. I'm going to be having my son look through it before he heads out to university. But from this Catholic perspective, you start off with three key things that every Catholic student should or perhaps must do to retain their faith. What are those three things and why are they important?
So these are simply the requirements listed by the Catechism of being a person in, we'll call it, good standing in the faith. The theological term is in the state of grace. So attending Mass regularly, that's your Sunday obligation, and attending Mass on required holy days. There are a handful of them per year, which I list in the book. Observing the required fasts, these are extremely light if you compare them to, the Muslim practices during Ramadan. The harshest day of fasting in the church on, say, Ash Wednesday and Good Friday still allow you to have two small meals and one big meal. So it's this is not, I don't think this is by any means impossible. And going to confession once per year. Now, I'll say that I think confession is an acquired taste, but it's something that's well worth doing a lot more often than that. I myself recommend once a month at minimum, and try to go once a week myself. It's just a great way to be aware of how you're growing and things that you need to work on, and it's also a way to see that your own moral perfection is not the point of your spiritual life. If you're looking at what you're doing wrong and having to tell somebody every week the worst things that you did in that last week, you very quickly detach from the idea that you're perfect and, saving yourself. You have to say, I'm not perfect, but then again, it wasn't ever about me, was it?
That is such a valuable lesson because, as we're talking about the stress of getting into college, you're 17, 18 years old, and you're wondering, am I ever going to make it? What's my full worth here? Then you get accepted somewhere, and then I know the whole process of the university is they make you feel welcome, and you're the best person in the world, and everything is great. So it's this kind of strange thing that it really messes with people's minds in that. And the part of the book that you talk about confession, I think, yeah, this is really important. It's neat to step back and you got all that talking around you, but if you step back and say, you know what, I do a lot of really good things, but I screw up every so often, I need to keep my humility in perspective here. I think that's a really important lesson that is very good.
I totally agree.
The other interesting thing as I was reading through this too is the ritualistic nature of these three things that you talk about. They're regular things. Attend Mass regularly. Get there Sunday morning. Get there during the holy days. Observe required fasts. And then get to confession at least once a year, if not more. And in the sociology of religion, we talk about these kind of rituals quite a bit because they keep reminding people there are other things that you have to do. It's more broader than just the ritual itself. You know, I tell this to students too who are going off to college. The number one thing for success in college is to make your bed every morning. Because right? If you make your bed every morning, you get disciplined in that, then you know how to study at, 10 o'clock, I have to be studying my sociology class or something. What's your thought on that kind of ritualistic practice? Was it hard to maintain those rituals? Did it help you in other aspects of your life?
I am a person of routine. I flourish when I am attentive to discipline in physical, emotional, spiritual, and even kind of social routines. So I'm all about that. I think getting up trying to get up at the same time, trying to get up right when your alarm goes off, studying when you're studying, being present to your friends when you're present, and not necessarily on your phone. These are all things that add up. It's not that you have to be perfect at all of these things all of the time, but if you become the kind of person who cultivates these habits, it becomes easier to achieve success in areas that require you to make sacrifices.
Mm-hmm. Yep, sacrifice is also very important here too. Sometimes we have to give up things that we don't want to, including time and time away from things that we enjoy. Your book is then divided into four sections. Each of them have a bit of reflection and advice, and these sections include community, prayer, academics, and then something you call living it out. I want to focus mostly on the community, academics, and the last section, given our time constraints, but I have to urge folks to pick up this book, especially if you're a student. That would be great. If you're a parent and you have a religious student who's going off to some kind of secular university, it's a great one. Don't miss out on the prayer section because, again, that's another ritual routine. Do it every day. That helps you in not only connecting with God, but in other areas of your life. But let's dig through these different chapters, and you give some really great pieces of advice. Let's start with community first. Why is community important, and how does a religious student find and build that community?
It's a great question. There's a reason why it comes first, and that's because I think it's really difficult to maintain your faith on a secular campus if you don't find people who are like-minded and who can give you support and inspiration. So the way I found it was by going to daily Mass. I found that there was a group of small, diverse, committed Catholics who could serve as an immediate community. I recommend all kinds of other ways to be involved in Catholic communities on campus. That's getting involved with the Catholic Club, which I did. I founded a Catholic sorority on campus. That's another avenue. Getting involved in service projects together, plugging into national organizations that tend to have groups on college campuses, like Focus or Opus Dei. And even if there isn't a strong Catholic group, sometimes the Protestant fellowships are just a great way to nourish your faith and to draw closer to God on a college campus. So I include a lot of different options on purpose because different campuses have different opportunities, but no matter where you are, you can find people who are going to be interested in growing in their faith.
You mentioned that you started a Catholic sorority. What was that like? I mean, my image of fraternities and sororities, these have been long established for 150 years or so, and they have a big, huge mansion just off the campus. And for you to start one, you didn't buy a mansion and have everybody pile in, right? Or how did you actually do this?
No. The way that I say this is we were as much of a sorority as our Catholicism would allow. So not the sort of binge drinking, promiscuous sense that you might get from sororities on other campuses is not quite right. But in the sense that it was a sisterhood where you had people who were focused on bonding over their faith, over community service, and over desire for fellowship, it was very much that. But we had, I would say, the Catholic community, we were convivial. We had fun parties. They were just not excessive or illegal.
Yeah, walk me through this process, though, of starting this up, because you mentioned you go to Mass every morning. Amazing, right? That's extreme discipline that is very admirable. You're probably seeing similar people, maybe not every day, but every couple days, say, oh, okay, I know you. When did this idea to create a sorority come into your head? And then what did this actually, or how did it actually manifest itself? Did you sign up as an official group on campus? Was this an informal thing? Did you have a set of bylaws? What was that about?
So we had a good model in the Knights of Columbus, who are an international fraternal Catholic organization, and usually they're kind of older guys who are handing out Tootsie Pops and doing very impressive patronage community service projects around the world. But they also had a fraternity, which was a group of, 25 young Catholic guys at Harvard who would meet together and watch movies and play games and do service and help the parish. And there were a couple girls before I came who liked to hang out with the Knights but couldn't join the Knights because they were women. And I said, well, I guess that means that there's probably a demand for a women's side of this. So I found an international sororal Catholic organization called the Daughters of Isabella, who do similar work to the Knights, but on a smaller scale. I contacted them, and I said, we'd like to get a group of yours going. They have their own bylaws, their own, traditions, and we agreed to abide by those, and we're able to bring people in under the auspices of their organization.
So what were some of the activities you did? You just got together and watched movies? Did you live in a similar arrangement, in a similar apartment, flat,
no,
or something?
No sorority house.
Okay.
We launched with a black tie ball. All the men showed up in tuxes and women's in gowns, and there was champagne/apple cider toast. There was a swing band, a live band. We had baby showers for underprivileged women in crisis pregnancy situations. We had pancake breakfast to raise funds for the parish. It was, it was an interesting combination of church stuff and college social stuff.
And how many people did you get participating in this initially, and then after you step away from campus, where was the membership?
We had to get 20 to sign up, and we had 35 founding members. I would imagine that my understanding is that the numbers have stayed pretty similar. There are only going to be a certain number of people at a given time who are interested in committing themselves to something like this, but the demand has stayed steady at that 35 or so.
Well, that's a really cool type of organization that you're doing there. One of the things that I'm interested in is there's been talk around Harvard and a few other universities of getting rid of some of these off-campus groups because they tend to be exclusionary and stuff. Was that part of the conversation when you were at Harvard, and what are your thoughts on that?
It wasn't. That was not a discussion that happened until a couple years after I was gone. I'm not sure exactly how it's affected the Knights and Daughters, except that my understanding is that they're still going. Perhaps they've, you know, flown under the radar enough that, and it's clear we're not sort of having these out of control parties where, you know, predatory situations arise and things. So, I think that's a complex issue. I know people who have had very positive experiences and are adamant that that the administration leave these organizations alone. And I also know from being a student there that the reputation of these clubs was that there was predatory behavior. So that's a tough call. I'm glad I don't have to make it.
Yeah. A few other bits of advice you have in that community section I want to talk about. One of them is just be Catholic. What does that mean?
Yeah, it's so funny. How I stayed Catholic at Harvard, just be Catholic. so what I meant, this may have been the chapter that underwent the most extensive editing from the original draft. It's a tricky point, and what it's saying is don't add an adjective to I am Catholic. Do not say I'm a liberal Catholic. Do not say I'm a traditional Catholic. Just be Catholic. Now, let me caveat that. The Catholic Church is universal. Her reach is very wide, and within a range of acceptable understandings, people are included. But there comes to be a point where if you disagree too much with the fundamental teachings of the Church, and this often happens with people who describe themselves as liberal Catholics, not Catholics who are also happen to be liberal or, you know, whatever, but liberal Catholics, that it can happen that they're not really committed to being Catholics in the full sense of the word. And likewise, I've seen people go off the rails being too conservative, which is thinking that the contributions of Vatican II, which is a council in the 1960s that reformed literature and tried liturgy and tried to explain the Church's disposition toward the modern world, there are people who think that Vatican II was not a legitimate council. And the fact is that the Church's teachings are very much a part of what it means to be Catholic, as are the modern councils and the modern Pope. So you have to, being a Catholic means embracing all of these things. You can question them and grow, but you can't reject them and call yourself Catholic in a helpful way. That can be really scandalous and divisive. So I recommend just be Catholic.
Now, everything that we've talked about up to this point is about finding people who are like you, finding Catholics who are like you, finding this community of support, and that I think is very important for people moving away from home for the first time. The danger of this is that you could enter into a bubble. I mean, I could imagine I want to find, you know, Catholics who went to Protestant schools in Southern California and are interested in medieval philosophy. That would probably be a group of one. So at least a very, very small group. But you have this point in that chapter that I think is also very essential, and that's make friends with people who are not like you. What's that about?
Well, I think some people pick up my book and think that it's a list of 40 things that I was really awesome at, and it's not true. This is a great example of one of those things that I wish I had done better when I was in school. I learned this when I was on the Rhodes Scholarship, and I was writing the book. I made some great friendships with people who are definitely not Catholic, and I've learned so much from them, and I admire them and appreciate them. And it got me thinking that if I had been more open to those relationships when I was in college, I probably would have made more of my experience at Harvard. Now, there's only so much you can do. On a college campus, you do have to make these decisions. And I think the much greater danger is not connecting with like-minded people and losing your anchor. But looking back on it, I was doing Catholic this and Catholic that with Catholic professors and Catholic friends, and it did get a little bit isolated sometimes. So I do recommend, for a number of reasons, trying to keep your finger on the pulse outside of your bubble, whatever your bubble happens to be.
Yeah, it's good advice. As long as you have that strong anchor, being able to meet and reach out to new people and share your experiences and put them in perspective with what they experience is, I think, very important. I mentioned that another section of the book is on prayer. We're going to skip over that, I should say, and let folks read the book themselves. The third section I found is very interesting, and it's on academics. And the question there is, how does a Catholic go about being a student that may be different than ye olde typical student? And you have a number of bits of advice there in terms of the classroom type of stuff that you see at universities. Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, what I recommend is just trying to find ways to intellectually grow in your faith. So the idea with these different sections is, you know, maybe pick something from each of them and try to be moving forward on them. So, you know, pick a new prayer, pick a new way to engage with your faith intellectually, perhaps each semester. And I give some ideas. It's not that you need to be doing all of them all the time, but some ways to engage with your faith academically are to read Catholic literature, to attend conferences where people are talking about this, find Catholic professors, see Catholic guest lecturers, and know where to look for answers. Understand that there are going to be other people who can out-argue you on the spot, but that you have resources to come back to if you get turned around.
One of the things you just mentioned was to find Catholic professors. How does one do that? Because we don't put a sign outside of our door saying evangelical professor here or Catholic professor there. Sometimes you can read doors and kind of figure out who's who, but, you know, professors, we kind of stick to our subjects, and, you know, especially if you're in the physics department, nobody's going to be asking you what your Catholicism or other faith is. So how do you find these Catholic professors?
By reputation, the Catholic community does tend to have a collective knowledge of who they are at any given time, and then we'll recommend to each other that they take classes by these professors. With Professor Tarrant, for example, it was quite clear because I saw him give a lecture in his Rome of Augustus course and then headed to Mass around noon and heard him lecturing. So sometimes it's pretty straightforward. But you're right, usually there isn't a big advertisement. It's trying to go with the knowledge of the community and then not being afraid to ask yourself when it becomes appropriate.
Now that connects you with classes you want to take and in the classroom environment, but as you mentioned, go see guest lectures as they come up, Catholic guest lectures, and I would imagine that one of the ways you do this is you just read the, you know, postings on the bulletin boards outside various departments and things like that. But also when you connect with these Catholic professors, they probably are telling you, hey, Robbie George is coming to the university. You should, you know, see this lecture. And is there also the opportunity to connect with some of these guest lecturers after they give their talk, perhaps at a dinner or a small gathering afterwards?
Certainly. That's almost always the case. And the amazing thing about being a Harvard student is you can create a platform for almost anybody you want to come. So you can, if Robbie George doesn't happen to be coming, you can help organize an event and see if you can get him to come. And then you can decide what you'd like to put together for the evening's activities, you know?
Yeah. And I would imagine that opens a lot of different doors that the just being a student in the classroom really doesn't avail yourself to. Did you have any personal experiences where you met some of these speakers and you say, oh, now I have other ideas what I can be doing with my professional life?
Yes. So this happened totally apart from Harvard. But Peter Kraft is one of my favorite Catholic philosophers, and he was giving a lecture my junior year near where my family lives in Southern California as a part of a group that my parents were in. And I asked if anybody was planning to pick up Dr. Kraft from the airport.
Mm-hmm.
I contacted the group. I said, does he need a ride? And they said, oh, that'd be great. That saves us. So I went and picked him up at the airport and talked to him that way. You just kind of have to take initiative and connect with these people. But Peter Kraft is at Boston College, so I would go see him occasionally once we were back on the East Coast. And I kept up that relationship that way.
That is such a great bit of advice, and that we oftentimes overlook when we think about these intellectual endeavors. It's all about the talk and the ideas floating around, but it's these in-between moments, picking somebody up at the airport or walking them to their next meeting, that you actually make a lot of these interesting points of contact that I've made myself and students have made with me. So never forget to always do that. That's a good one. The last section that you talk about is living it out, which sounds like some kind of millennial hipster talk for dancing at a disco or something. What does this living it out section encompass?
It's so funny that I think in the introductory remarks you said prayer, community, and something you call living it out, which is the precise wording I use. Living it out was a catch-all category for anything that didn't fit in these other parts. But it's an important category. It's saying there is something beyond studying your faith in school or going to church or being part of the Catholic Club that is still an important part of being a person of faith. I remember in high school, somebody said, if we lived in a country in which being Christian were illegal, would they have sufficient evidence to charge you? So are you living a life that is fully integrated and obviously Christian, even in ways quite apart from prayer or Catholic Club? So these are, that's what the category is about.
I love that question. Right. If we lived in a country where Christianity were illegal, would there be sufficient evidence to charge you? And that's a tough question. That's one of these that, early Christians went through during the periods of the persecutions in the first 300 years. And, some people say, yeah, there is. And I'm going to stand up and I'm going to, tell my faith is strong and proud and they might throw me to the lions. Other people are like, me, got it all wrong here. How does one actually go about living it out? What were some of the bits of advice that you give to students here in this section?
I think the most significant part, maybe the juiciest bits, are things that people would expect to be addressed in the book. What do you do at a college party if you're a serious Catholic? How do you handle being around drinking and drugs and sex? How do you handle dating? Another unrelated point is about making sure you rest on Sundays. It's things like that. I'm happy to talk about whichever of those you think is most useful.
Tell me about the one about resting on a Sabbath, because this is a lesson that I still have to learn. I'm in my 50s, and I have people come up to me and says, you got to take a break. I'm one of these people that just dives into my career and just does it 24/7 all the time. But as I get older, I'm really understanding the point of the Sabbath. And as I looked at that in your book, I'm like, wow, for a Harvard student, it's all academics. It's do this, do that, extracurricular, this, that. How do you have time to rest on the Sabbath? And what do you do when you rest on the Sabbath?
You know, I just can't imagine not doing it, because you end up getting in this mode where there's always more to do. And there's always, even when you're resting, you feel like you shouldn't be, because there's something else you should be doing. And taking one day and saying, this is, you know, even apart from religious reasons, or I think God commands it because it's good for us, but even just from a completely secular perspective, having a time every week when you say, I am not going to feel guilty about not doing other things, because what I'm supposed to be doing right now is resting. And that's going to make everything else, it's going to make my work more productive. But I actually, I subscribe to the Joseph Pieper thesis. So he writes a book called Leisure, the Basis of Culture. And he says that people think that they rest in order to work better, but that's actually not the point of life. The point of life is to work in order that we may do the things that we truly love in the best ways. And for Pieper as a Catholic, and for me, that means, you know, resting in God and reorienting, becoming most connected to the things that matter most, reflecting. So that would be the ideal Sabbath, would be I've carved out the time, I've been disciplined on Saturday, that's the big deal, instead of taking Saturday afternoon off, making sure that the laundry and homework and errands and all of that are done, and then really taking Sunday to, I like sleeping in, going to kind of a mid-morning mass, having brunch with friends, being leisurely in the afternoon, maybe reading or continuing to, sometimes I would just continue to hang out with those friends all afternoon until dinner, and then we'd part ways after dinner. But the point is that during the week, you knew you were going to have those times off, and when you were having those times off, you knew that they were about pointing yourself to the only things that really mattered.
The other thing that I want to ask about this chapter, and you give bits of advice in different sections here, is how to resist those temptations that the campus life brings. I think that is probably the biggest challenge for anybody who is a young adult, away from home for the first time, outside of your bubble that you might have grown up in. How difficult was that for you, and what kind of ways did you be Catholic at parties, saying, no, I'm not going to do this, I'm not getting involved in this, all those different temptations that might be out there?
Sure. And this could be the topic of its own podcast, the distinction between legal and illegal drinking, the distinction between drinking and doing drugs, the sexual promiscuity is a whole different matter. So I'm going to give the most high-level answer I can, which is, if you make friends with the right people, you're not going to have to constantly be resisting temptation. There are people on college campuses who do not get wasted every weekend for fun. So I really didn't find it that hard. Had I been looking for those things, I could have found them at Harvard, but I wasn't, and my friends weren't either. So while we had fun, it wasn't, I wouldn't ever say that I was put in a position where I felt I had to choose between my friends and my faith.
It seems to flow from all those things that you mentioned earlier, the, you know, sticking with the attending mass, have a regular, you know, prayer schedule and things like that. It all kind of follows through and makes it easier.
And I guess the point, I just want to insert a point here, which is that it can start to, I know that that can sound so robotic or sterile, and it's really not. It's, for me, living a disciplined life and then being around friends who were living moral lives was such a joyful thing. It meant that I was protected from a lot of the things that a lot of other people were being hurt by. And I was finding connections with people that were much deeper than the fact that we got drunk together. I found that it really did make it easier for me to be happier. You know, I don't know if that's everybody's experience, but I had a very joyful and social time in college, and I think it was precisely because of my faith.
Yeah, I can imagine, as you're talking about the, you know, what you did on Sundays, just attend a later mass, have brunch with people, and then you're with them at dinner. All that time in between is just fun. You're walking around parks, you're maybe playing a few games, or, you know, laughing at different things. It really does open the doors to lots of opportunities. Let me finish off with some final reflections from you. You're still quite young, just a few years from college graduation, but since you wrote this book and you've been in the workaday world now, and including the fairly brutal world of presidential politics and administration, are there any insights that you've developed since you wrote the book that may have surprised you, or you might want to go back and say things, or something, maybe a next book that says how to be Catholic in the working world or the political world?
Yeah, it's such a great question. I now live in a community in Northeast Washington called Brookland, like Brooklyn with but land, and they call it the Little Rome. It has 26 tabernacles within walking distance of my apartment. There are 10 daily masses on campus at the Catholic University of America. And if you walk down the street, you see religious monks and nuns in habits. It's just a very uniquely Catholic place in a way that I didn't experience in college or graduate school. And I realize that not everybody can live in a place like this, but it has been such a blessing and refreshment for me. I have incredible friends, and being in a community that I literally can breathe in my Catholicism when I'm at work and not at work, but when I was working at the State Department and I was living here, that was such an important support for me. So, you know, I think it's a matter of figuring out what resources are available to you at your point in life and trying to make the most of them. For now, that means that I'm able to actually live in a community that tends to value my faith, and that's been a huge blessing.
Very cool. One last question. What is next for Aurora Griffin?
I will be matriculating to the Stanford Graduate School of Business in the fall.
Wow. Very good. Making it back to the West Coast.
At least for now, yes.
And getting away from those cold winters, at least for a little bit. But very, very cool. A lot of great advice here in the book, How I Stayed Catholic at Harvard. Not only for Catholics, it's for Protestants, for anybody of any religious faith, and I think for everybody, not only students but parents. My guest today has been Aurora Griffin. Aurora, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you for having me. It was such a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.